Our sponsor today is none other than our Patreon members. You folks are bringing swords and HEMA to listeners worldwide, so thank you. To support our work and receive exclusive benefits, visit patreon.com/swordwomen. Welcome to By the Sword, where we discuss the modern study of historical European martial arts, or HEMA, with instructors, experts, and martial artists from all over the world. In this episode of the podcast, we meet Asian arms and armour expert Ranjit Singh in the UK. We take a look at some beautiful pieces from his collection and talk about his experience as part of the antique weapons community. The interview was recorded on Instagram Live, 18 July 2021.
Hello.
Hi. Hi, Fran.
Hi, Ranjit.
How are you?
I'm good. It's pretty warm here, but I'm in the shade.
Good, good. I'm in the loft. So pretty warm up here. So hence the rosy cheeks.
Whereabouts are you based?
I'm in Leamington Spa, which is in Warwickshire.
Gorgeous.
What about you?
I'm in Godalming in Surrey.
Surrey, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, equally gorgeous.
Yeah.
Even more so, maybe.
Oh, it's debatable. So thank you so much for coming on the show. Really been looking forward to speaking to you about a completely different angle to what I normally talk about, because this channel is all about European arms and martial arts. So we're going to look at with you today into antique Asian arms and armour, which you collect and sell.
Yep.
So to start off with, you've been doing this since 2014, being an expert and a dealer in Asian antiques and armour. How did you get into antique weapons? How did it all begin?
Slight correction. I've been involved as a collector since 99.
Right.
2014 is the date I ditched my day job and became a full-time dealer.
Right.
So that's where you got that date from.
Mm-hmm.
And you might like to hear that the way I got into it was through martial arts. So I'm sure you can relate to that. And I know lots of your followers will relate to that.
Yeah.
Purely a martial artist to begin with. And I bought an antique sword on recommendation from my instructor. So I could train with something realistic and something correctly balanced and all of that. And it just snowballed from there. I bought another one and another one. And before I knew it, I had a bit of a armory like you have behind you there. So you know exactly what I mean.
Yeah.
It just went mad, and I decided, okay, I need to refine the collection and need to sell things on in order to buy other things. And so that's where the dealing side came about. And eventually I thought, why not do, you know, something I love as a living, if I can earn enough money to pay the bills. And yeah, so far so good, it's working out. So yeah, I'm lucky enough to be a full-time dealer.
So you're living the dream.
Yeah, very much. Yeah. It doesn't always feel like a dream, I have to admit. But I'm very lucky. But like any jobs, it's got its downsides. And running a business is never an easy thing. But I'm surrounded by the things I love, like-minded people. That's kind of my backstory.
So the martial art in question, I'm assuming that's Gatka.
No. No, I started off with Filipino.
Oh, really?
A bit of Indonesian martial arts, Eskrima mainly.
Okay.
And I studied with a couple of instructors in the Midlands. And I did a bit of Thai boxing, and I just, you know, dipped in and out, and I couldn't really find something that, you know, resonated personally until I found Shastra Vidya, which you may confuse with Gatka.
Right.
Gatka is the display art, the,
right.
You know, the not the dramatization, but, you know, what was used to wow the crowds at festivals in India, that was Gatka. Mm. And that came over into the West with a couple of instructors, and probably has been mistaken for the true for a true martial art. But the instructor I trained with in my 20s until I kind of retired myself and became a dealer in my 30s, he brought to the West Nidhar Singh. Some people may be familiar with him. So yeah, he introduced me to Shastra Vidya. And that's where I felt real good
about that.
It gave me a real good grounding for antique weaponry, actually, because he was able to show me why things were made a certain way. And, you know, if you purely come into it with a dealer or a commercial eye, you may not appreciate why something is the shape it is or why it has the balance it has. You know, things I was picking up when I first started collecting and dealing, I think, well, this doesn't feel right. It's not well balanced or whatever. And then a martial artist can say, oh, no, it's balanced that way because it was used for this function. You know, it was a cavalry sword as opposed to an infantry sword. So it's given me a really good grounding.
Excellent. And what was that first sword that you bought?
What was it? It was a cheap £50. Well, say cheap £50, you know, nothing. £50 is still an amount of money, isn't it? But that, you know, that was 99. And it was a £50 sword from a local antique centre. And it was a Ferengi. I have got a Ferengi, but it's the other side of the room. A Ferengi is, the term means foreigner. You know, it's an Indian term for foreigner. Mm-hmm. And it was the practice of taking, and this was right in the, you know, even in the 16th, 17th centuries and continued right up until, you know, early 20th century, the practice of taking a European blade, which was in high demand in India, mm-hmm. and putting it in a, marrying it with an Indian hilt. Mm-hmm. And the sword was termed as a Ferengi by the locals. And then they began to copy the European blades, normally German imported blades or Italian imported blades. The Indians started copying the blades and using those blades and still being termed a Ferengi. I mean, the kind of irony is that in the 16th, 17th century, India was making equally good, if not more superior blades than Europe was. You know, mm-hmm. India developed a crucible oven and ovens that could reach far higher temperatures than anything that Europe could quite early on. And hence why India and the East in general, was producing Damascus Woods blades and is famed for it.
So
that was my first sword.
And what was the martial art that you were practicing at the time that your instructor asked you to, suggested that you get a real sword?
Yeah, well, it was a screamer, but my instructor was also a Sikh. So I don't think the recommendation was a pure screamer recommendation. It was kind of, you know, you should have an Indian or a Sikh sword, you know, so you know what one feels like.
Yeah.
And that went on to, it was one of my favourite swords, the Ferengi, big basket hilt, a bit like this isn't a Ferengi, but the hilt would be the same, big basket hilt.
Mm-hmm.
This has got an Indian blade, which I'll go through later, but a two-handed sword.
Oh, fantastic.
You could swap it there like that, two-handed.
Goodness me.
So yeah, I'm quite a fan of those basket-hilted swords, which Ferengis often were.
So you, sorry, I'm just, one second. Just got a call come through. So I think it was last year you exhibited at the European Fine Art Fair. Was it 2020?
Yeah.
So that's a huge international event. One of the world's leading art fairs. What was that experience like?
It was I've exhibited at art fairs before, and when you're taking this field, arms and armor, to a general art audience, you get mixed reactions usually. I was in Paris once in a gallery. I set up a gallery exhibition, and a lady walked in, and she spoke French. I couldn't understand her fully, but one of my French friends who was there said, oh, she came in and she said she doesn't like swords. Ironically, she had a necklace, and the necklace had a suba, a Japanese sword guard, on the necklace.
Oh,
so
really?
She came in and proclaimed she didn't like swords, but yet she was wearing
little did she know.
But I've got to say, in the case of Tefaf in Maastricht, it was a really well-informed audience. And, you know, no negativity. It was all very positive. And they saw the arts and the craft involved in what I was showing. So it was a really good experience all around. Yeah, but very different from my background is, and people who collect arms and armour will be far more comfortable at an arms fair, which we have many in the UK, or did have before lockdown started. And I know America has a great tradition of, they call them gun shows.
Yeah.
But they're somewhere where you can go and buy a sword, an antique sword. So I'm most comfortable there, you know, and it's very relaxed, and you can go and buy a bacon sandwich for a couple of pound and chat to another collector in a very relaxed atmosphere. Whereas the Maastricht, the Tefaf fair is very upmarket
You've got Picassos and things going.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, equally enjoyable in a different way.
Yeah.
You can't buy a bacon sandwich for £2.
Buy a Picasso for a couple of millions. So.
Yeah.
And something else, so that's like a very different approach, I guess. It's more about the art, as you say, rather than the weapon.
Yeah.
And it's a different vibe. But you are also, I mean, the things you collect and sell are pieces of art in themselves. They're not just, you know, utilitarian objects. Mm. Obviously, they've got their history and their heritage and everything, but they are sumptuously beautiful. And that kind of art connection, you're also on the board of Asian Arts in London. So tell us what that involves.
So Asian Arts in London is an annual London-based event where various galleries across the city open up, and institutions and museums get involved. It's a celebration of Asian art in general, and it always has been very China-centric.
Right.
But there has been, over the last few years, a shift towards India and the Islamic world, which is really nice to see, that it's becoming a more broad, well-balanced event.
Mm-hmm.
And I joined the board to help do that, to help make it a more broad and balanced event. And, you know, it's part of my kind of ethos, as is Tefaf, to bring this niche to a wider audience and to show people, you know, these are not just pointy, stabby things.
Yeah.
They're things of immense beauty.
Yeah.
And often in the Asian world, they're things of religious significance, cultural significance, and they're portable works of art. So that, you know, that's why I joined the board. Well, was lucky enough to be invited to join. But probably more exciting, something maybe you're not aware of, is I've recently been asked to join the Council of the Arms and Armour Society.
Oh, wow.
A very illustrious and old organisation here in the UK. Again, I think it's a huge compliment.
Congratulations. Thank you.
Yeah. I hope I can use my position to show accessibility. It's an old organisation, so maybe people are a little bit intimidated, you know, from approaching or asking to join as members. Watch this space
So they approached you and asked you to join us.
Yeah, I've been a member for quite a few years, and they produce the most amazing regular newsletters and an annual journal, which has got some wonderful academic, every year has wonderful academic papers.
Mm-hmm.
Increasingly over the last few years, they've been including papers on Asian arms and armour from various scholars. That's a lovely organisation that brings both sides, you know, the European and the Asian world all together. So it is a general arms and armour society.
There's a lot of questions coming up about that in the chat here. It's a great achievement. So you've got a lot of fans here. And someone's asking, what is their mission?
Oh, God, you're putting me on the spot. I'm probably too early in my councilship to be a mouthpiece for them. What is their mission? I'm going to get my hand slapped by the rest of the council now if they see it, because I don't know off by heart what the mission is. I think bringing scholarship to the world of collecting arms and armour is important, to represent collectors.
Yeah.
And dealers, I suppose, and the trade in general. To represent them in terms of, in various terms, but, you know, I can think that with pressures coming from society in general, maybe legal pressures, there needs to be somebody there to fight our corner, you know, so we can carry on collecting in a responsible way. And so I think the Arms and Armour Society provide a really good and credible mouthpiece for that.
Now, talking of legal, the legal standpoint, I'm not, you know, au fait with the laws on importing blades, etc. But I gather that it has been made increasingly difficult for importers and dealers of antique swords to get stuff into the country and out again. Any efforts to work with that, I mean, in the name of safety, it's quite ridiculous, really. These are not, you know, these are art objects, basically. Mm. It's quite ludicrous, the sort of hoops that people are made to have to jump through. But anything that can help that cause is worthwhile. Just to let the people watching know, in about 10 minutes, I'm going to invite the folks who are watching to submit questions for Ranjit. I'm going to go through, because people have been sort of putting things in, I'm going to go through and see what people are saying. But for now, I'd just like you to start. I mean, the reason we're all here is because we want to see the amazing swords, some of the amazing swords in your collection, obviously not all of them. But let's just see, take us through what you've got for us today.
Okay, I thought I would start with one of my favourite Asian swords.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Bhutanese short sword. I'm going to just slide the stand back so you can all... Sorry about the wobbly stand. It's a Bhutanese short sword.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll show you the blade. The blade is, I suppose, quite unique in the Asian world. So it's used in many of the Himalayan cultures, Tibet, Bhutan, primarily. As you can see, it's just kind of a straight chopping sword with this clipped end. And if I just show you those lines on the blade are the folding of the steel.
Oh, they're not fillers.
And it's known as hairpin folding.
Oh.
And pretty much only found in the Himalayan cultures, that style of folding. But I just like I like the size of it, the mobility of it, and I'm coming from a martial arts point of view. It's just a really practical, efficient hacking weapon, you would call it.
So this is like an everyday workman-like sword, or does it have a sort of cultural significance?
Yeah, I mean, usually they have some elements of decoration.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can see the pommel here with these kind of
carved,
very kind of Himalayan, Tibetan, Bhutanese scroll work. And then you have this kind of interlocking Y-shaped panel, which is meant to take influence from very early armour from that region.
That's gorgeous.
And then you have Buddhist symbology there. So you have a kind of a flaming jewel and a conch right there. So they're two of the eight auspicious Buddhist symbols.
Right.
So they generally with Asian weaponry, if it's not glaringly obvious, because often these do have the eight Buddhist Ashtamangala symbols, then there will be something hidden away in the sword. Quite often with Indian swords you have three of something, and that's to signify the holy trinity. Brahma, Shiva, Brahma, Vishnu, Mahesh, another word for Shiva. So a lovely thing about Asian, especially Indian weaponry, that kind of hidden cultural, not cultural, religious iconography.
Mm-hmm.
And the sword is a very important religious object for many of the warrior castes of India.
Mm-hmm.
The Hindus believe that the goddess resides within the sword.
Right.
Or certainly if you beautify the sword and you treat the sword with the respect it deserves and they worship the sword, the goddess will enter the sword, and thus the owner, the warrior that wields it, will be victorious in battle. And the Sikhs believe in a similar way, but more in a more somatic way, that the sword is the god or the goddess.
Right.
And it represents God. So it is a hugely important thing. That brings me swiftly on, actually, to one of my favorite swords, which...
That is awesome.
Kind of in my private collection, really.
Wow.
It's a Zulfikar sword. And the Zulfikar blade is used throughout the Islamic Kingdom on battle standards in early Ottoman history, and it relates to Muhammad. And what I like about it also relates to the Sikhs as well, and anything to bring to show similarities of two people or cultures is a nice thing.
Mm-hmm.
But this one's 17th century, from the Deccan, which is the south east corner of India. It relates to Muhammad. It was meant to have been a gift from the angel Gabriel to Muhammad, the Zulfikar or the Dulfikar. And Muhammad is meant to have gifted it to his son-in-law, Ali, who then used it to defeat the great mighty Meccan warrior. I don't know who that was, but it's Islamic history, and I need to I need to read up on that. But
I was going to say, would these two swords that you've just shown, would they be like civilian weapons? Obviously, someone of fairly high societal standing, or would they be military?
Well, the question Ash is going to lead me on to my second point about this sword is the way it relates to the Sikhs is because an identical one was gifted by the 10th guru, the 10th Sikh guru, when there was 10 living Sikh gurus, was gifted to Maharaja of a small part of Punjab, because the Maharaja was ordered by the then Mughal emperor Aurangzeb to execute the guru's two youngest sons. And the Maharaja declined. And as reward, the guru gifted him an identical sword. So it says that explanation should answer your question in that it was somebody very important, would have owned this sword. Mm. Certainly a ruler of a small area or a very rich businessman, trader maybe. And the Bhutanese sword, again, it's decorated quite richly in silver, with a silver shape. So it says that whoever had it had some money, and the blade's very well made. So you would say, other than telling you that it was made for somebody important, I can't really say.
It's impossible to say. But like what you were saying about having the swords embellished to imbue them with the goddess's, intentions, or they are the goddess themselves. When we see swords in museums and stuff, and we see these really richly ornate weapons, we tend culturally, probably from a Western perspective, we kind of tend to think, well, it's so richly decorated, that can't have been a practical weapon. It must have been just for ceremonial purposes, or it must have been just a gift and nobody ever used it. What's your take on whether, these sort of bejeweled, gilt, highly decorated weapons would have been used in warfare or in actual fights?
I think there's some truth to that statement. It's unlikely something bejeweled, gilt, very expensive, would be used, but I'm sure many of them were made to be used. Mm. It's not that they couldn't be used, they weren't functional or able to do the job. I'm sure they could, but inevitably, if you're rich enough to have a bejeweled sword, you're going to be one of the last people onto the battlefield.
Yeah.
And if you are going to lead from the front, you might leave your most precious sword behind and take your most trusty, heavy sword that you don't mind damaging or getting blood over. Mm-hmm. Unless you're really vain like me, then maybe you would.
Or you're going to die.
Yeah,
so I'll go out in style.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably where the European and the Asian cultures come together, in that there was probably a little bit of superstition, probably the wrong word, but a belief that, that your last action, whether it's on the battlefield or not, you're going to be remembered for. So, yeah, why not be remembered for looking the part and having a good-looking weapon?
Yeah, I mean, they are status symbols, let's face it. They're not just given or owned by people of high status or high rank. They are to show off with.
Yeah, exactly.
So what time is it now? All right, we're at the halfway mark. So I've got a mess. We've got a question in the question box. Let's just see what we've got here. From Cam Singh 1699, can you do a seminar for children and young teens interested in learning about the various different arms? Ooh, it's gone. Arms and armor and their different uses. Is that something that you'd be up for, Ranjit? Do you think it's important for kids to learn this stuff?
seminar. Seminar sounds like a big commitment. It sounds like a 2 or 3 day thing. I would definitely consider doing some kind of workshop.
Yeah.
If not seminar, workshop for kids. I've got a local school who teaches Mandarin to their kids, and they've asked me to come in and show them some Chinese weaponry, which I've happily agreed to do. If Cam wants to send me a message,
yeah,
we can definitely talk about that.
Sounds like a great introduction for kids into sort of history and art and martial arts as well.
What kid doesn't love swords?
Exactly. I mean, who has not picked up a stick in their childhood at some point and sort of waved it about, whacked a few trees with it?
Yeah.
It's all part of growing up, isn't it? I'm just checking through, see if anyone's asked any questions here in the comments. Yeah, someone is asking, this is an interesting question. Sodising 1234 says, are swords running out because everyone is keeping them? I mean, is it hard? Does that mean if everyone's collecting the swords and keeping them in collections, does that make them harder and harder to find?
That's a great question. And very relevant to me and the collecting community in general. And something I think about a lot, because a lot of my clients are mature in age, not all of them, but many of them. And they were collecting here in the UK in the 60s and 70s. And they were finding amazing things, really amazing, world-class museum quality things, and finding them for very little money. Which is great for them, because they're very, very valuable now. So yes, in a way, things do kind of run out, but that you can't forget the circle of life. People move on. People will pass on, and their collections will enter the market again. So unless things are being destroyed, which I'm happy to say they're not.
Or forgotten about. That's the other thing. If someone passes on and their family doesn't know about their collection, like it happens with things like with books, for example. One of the books that I worked on was left in a family's barn for 60 years and they didn't know it was there. And it's just like, it could have been completely lost to time, but it just happened to get taken to the Wallace collection and it was translated. So yeah, it's just like one of those things that's part of the trade, I guess. You just got to accept that things will appear and disappear as time goes on.
Yeah, it's pure luck, I think, whatever turns up on the market. And as a dealer, people ask me, what have you got new, what's come in? It's very difficult to say at any one time. I think you asked me what have I got coming up soon. Apart from what I've physically got, what I've acquired recently, I can't predict what's going to come in. Tomorrow I could make the discovery of my lifetime.
Yeah.
It's which is the wonderful thing, I suppose, about my job. I sometimes go to sleep. I can't sleep at night, literally.
Because it's just too exciting.
Tomorrow somebody might ring me up today and say, come and see me tomorrow, I've got this thing. Somebody called me actually last year and said they've got a Sikh helmet for sale. And for those who know, a Sikh helmet, a real Sikh helmet, is a bowl with space for a top knot for the long hair at the top. And apart from a few in a private collection, there's a handful of museum collections and that's it. So when he told me he had one, I literally couldn't sleep. Sadly, when I got there, it was a modern replica. So you do not know what's gonna come up and what isn't. So
So is that quite common that things turn out to be replicas rather than the real deal?
No, because the people I work with, generally they have a good understanding of the subject.
Mm-hmm.
Those incidents might happen if you have a member of the public mm-hmm. that is not a collector and they found something belonging to a relative in the house. They completely do not know what it is. Then it happens. But generally, people I work with on a regular basis know exactly what they have.
Sorry, there's more stuff coming in here. Islamic treasures, please, some information about Asad Allah, the legend.
How's he spelling that?
Asad, next word, Allah.
Asad Allah.
Yeah, sorry, my mispronunciation.
Yeah, it's okay. Asad Allah was a famed sword maker, Iranian sword maker. Sorry, I've touched the wrong part of the screen.
It's all right.
You've gone. Okay, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you fine. It's fine.
He was a famed... Oh, there you go. He was a famed Iranian sword maker from the 12th, 13th century. I'd have to check that.
Mm-hmm.
But he produced... No, it wasn't that early. It was the 14th or the 15th century. And he was famed for making wonderful woods, blades, woods Damascus. And I'm going to explain that term for you, woods.
Yeah.
You may know, but it's there's a huge misconception about the term. That woods Damascus steel, and I'll show you an example. This is a dagger blade.
Yeah.
Can you see the...
So it's very shiny.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get...
Is there a kind of pattern?
Yeah, there's... I'll describe it to you because that you're not going to be able to see it, are you? Which pattern is... It's like marbling.
Yeah.
Like you have marbled paper. It's a marbling pattern on the steel. Very, very tight grains. Very irregular in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You might get a little bit of repetition, but it's like watered pattern. And that's a very common term for it, watered steel.
Yeah. Like watered silk kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And the steel is, the misconception is that the steel is folded.
Right.
A little bit like the Japanese make their steel folded and heated and folded and heated. And it isn't, it's baked.
Oh.
And I was talking about the high temperatures Indian ovens were able to achieve. The iron is heated to such a temperature that it melts and it loses its, they term it a slag. It loses its impurities.
Yeah.
And you're left with a very pure steel, which is then forged, and a very light acid is brushed on to bring out this wonderful pattern. And he was the living master of his time. And he has been copied hugely over the centuries. And I would say the majority of the swords that you see with the marking, the Iranian blades you see with his marking are copies.
Mm-hmm.
I think he allowed his closest students to use his marking. So some of them are from his workshop, but generally a lot of them are later. But yeah, it's...
So did he have a secret technique that only a few were allowed to know?
Yeah, it's always been a bit of a mystery, the creation of woods. And I think until about 7 or 8 years ago, it was a lost secret. We had lost the art of making woods.
Mm.
And then you had some Jordanians, you had some Indians and some Americans start working on rediscovering the technique. And they've managed to find it, which is great, but for a collector or dealer, it's problematic because the replicas they're making are fantastic.
Yeah, hard to distinguish.
Yeah, if you get a newly made woods blade and you stick it in an antique hilt, it becomes very difficult.
Mm.
And that's when my experience comes into action. and other people, you know, other experts.
The collective knowledge.
So, yeah, I mean, I would not advise buying a Mughal dagger like the one here, jade hilted Mughal dagger.
Mm.
I would not advise buying one of these from an unchecked source, from an auction, a small auction house, a regional auction house. Very dangerous. Some auction houses are worse than others.
Mm-hmm.
And a non-specialist dealer, you wouldn't buy one of those from, unless you were sure. So you would check with somebody like me.
Yeah, get expert advice.
Yeah.
Well, this is a good question from the same person, Kamsing1699. In the quest to make a perfect sword with today's technology, would you say the perfect sword has already been made, or is there still potential for something more superior like titanium swords?
The perfect sword. That's very subjective.
It's very subjective, isn't it?
Yeah.
Everyone knows what the perfect sword is. It's the one they want the best.
Yes. It's very subjective. I think for Cam, if he can't find the antique sword that is perfect for him, then he needs to understand what is perfect for him. What is the specification for the perfect sword for Cam Singh 1699? And if he has somebody with the right skills to commission that person to make him that sword,
mm-hmm.
Cost allowing, I suppose.
Yeah. Question here from Sodis Singh 1234. Are there many other women in the market? It's rare to see females. Are there many women antique arms dealers, I think is the question? Or is it more of a male preserve?
I mean, we're talking about a small group of people, you know.
I'm assuming everybody knows everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, so
community.
I suppose, you know, if I say to you, I don't know any female dealers that specialise in arms and armour. Actually, I do know one. I mean, she does a little bit of general art as well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's only, you know, if I was talking about something scientific, the sample size is small anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
But that said, the leading females in general, the arms and armor, especially Asian side, are female. You have Francesca Levy.
Oh, yeah.
From the Royal Correction Trust. I know she's a good friend of yours.
Yeah.
So, you know, she's one of the leading lights. You have Marina Vialon in from Paris.
And Rachel Freak as well.
Sorry. Rachel. Yeah. Marina specialises in European equestrian equipment, but has a great understanding of arms and armour in general. So some of the leading lights are female. Obviously we need more, shall I say. It would be great to have more female.
Tiny sample size, but from my, you know, inexperienced eye, it seems like the women in the antiques arms and armor sort of sphere are mainly working on the conservator side of things.
Curatorial. Yeah,
curatorial.
They're doing the clever stuff.
Sorry?
They're doing the clever stuff. Haven't got the capacity.
The boys like collecting the toys kind of thing. Yeah. So another question here from, please excuse my pronunciation, folks, Meng Dishuan. Who were the major blade suppliers from the 17th century? I think I'm taking that to mean which countries were producing a lot of blades in the 17th century.
Yeah, I touched on earlier that Solingen in Germany were supplying a lot to India. I know Italian and Spanish blades went out to India, but India was producing huge amounts for its own market, you know, for internal use. And of course, I'm sure there were great sword producing centres all around the world. So it all really depends on, you know, specifically which geographically what you're talking about, but hopefully that answers in part.
Yeah. Islamic Treasuress says, please, I need Mr. Runjeet's opinion about any material we can say is better than old roots.
It depends on the function of, you know, again, I mean, it comes back to subjectivity and, you know, what are you using that sword for? If it's for kind of hand-to-hand infantry fighting, then maybe you wouldn't use a fine piece of wood. I don't know. It really depends. It really depends on the use. I mean, pattern welded steel with Indian blades was used, much of it used by the Sikhs. You know, you don't find many Sikh swords with Woot's blades, for example.
Right.
So that was favoured. Mm-hmm. I guess it was not as brittle as Woot's. So, you know, it's again, it's a subjective thing. But, you know, no doubt that Woot's was beautiful and very high quality steel that could be sharpened to an edge and hold an edge for a long time.
So, yeah, I was going to say, beyond the kind of aesthetic of the Woot's steel, is it prized mainly for, I was going to ask what qualities it was prized for, but you just answered the question I was about to ask. So it's for holding an edge,
yeah,
being, because of the lack of impurities. But you said it also could be brittle.
Yeah, it can be.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not a metallurgist, but the tight steel structure allows it to have an extremely fine edge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as opposed to something like pattern welded steel with a wider grain structure.
Mm-hmm. Thierry, the sword guy who I interviewed a few weeks back, says the perfect sword is a spadroon. Science.
Wow.
I was gonna ask you what was the first piece that you bought, which you answered quite early on, but I'm gonna ask you now instead, what was the first piece that you sold? Do you remember?
I unlike a lot of people, I don't hold on to things. You know, I don't have this attachment.
Don't get attached.
So I think that helps as a dealer.
Yeah.
There are things that I won't sell, but, you know, so the first sword I ever bought, I sold it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I went about things fairly...
You upgrade.
Clinically. Yeah, exactly. And I would advocate that, you know, that would be my advice to any collector.
Yeah.
Is do not get attached to things.
Yeah.
You know, be looking to improve on your collection.
Yeah. So switching things out in your inventory.
Yeah, I mean, if you're not using, I mean, if martial arts, I'm looking behind you now, martial arts point of view, if there's stored in that rack that you're not using anymore, not as much, why not swap it out for something that you will use?
That's,
you know,
you're right on the money there. I need to not get so attached to them and thinking of them as my babies and thinking,
yeah,
time for you to leave the nest.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
right. Somewhere where you're going to get appreciated. You know?
Very cliche, but it's very true. Yeah.
Another comment here from Thierry. Would you say that Woot's is overly sought after in collecting spheres compared to just a simply good sword?
Yes and no. I think it's completely a viable thing and an admirable thing for somebody to collect good woods. If that's what they want to do, then great, fantastic.
Yeah.
I know plenty of collectors who couldn't care about the type of steel.
Mm-hmm.
They just want a rare, well-made, something in good condition, and a beautiful object. You know, they don't really care about the type of steel it is. But yeah, you do get people who you know, who are fanatic, Woot's fanatics, and that's fine. It's great. we don't need people like that. We do need fanatical collectors. You know, it makes the world, it makes our world go round. Because if you rely on those, the people that I mainly sell to, if you rely on those people, then the market will probably grind to a bit of a halt.
Yeah.
So you need people to be old school. I call them stamp collectors.
Yeah.
They want one of everything. You know, those guys that collect stamps and they want.
I want the complete set.
Yeah, you need those people. And those people are important, not just in that commercial sense, but they provide that snapshot that sometimes you need. There's a guy in Derbyshire who collects South Indian weaponry, Roy Alvis. And his collection, it's catalogued, by the way. There's a book, The Hindu Warrior. And his book gives you a snapshot of that part of the world, South India, between the centuries 17 and 19. He gives you that snapshot of, you know, what was being produced in that area. Mm. So you do need those people. So Thierry, stick with, if you've got somebody collecting just roots, then, you know, shove all the roots you can in that direction.
Give the people what they want.
Yeah.
it's people's passion that makes a community thrive and keeps it going. Whether any community, whether that's martial arts, whether it's antiques, history. Jack Gallant says, but collecting is all about getting attached to things we don't use.
Well, I mean, not if you're a martial artist. Then that's
no.
It is collecting things we don't really need, isn't it? He's got a point there. I mean, my, what I was referencing is that sell that £50 sword, or I mean, I'm not necessarily talking about value, but for this example, I will sell that £50 sword to buy the £60 sword, you know, because it's a little bit better.
Yeah.
A higher quality thing.
Quality, not quantity.
Constantly upgrading is what I would.
Yeah, keep upgrading.
Advocate.
This is very topical. Well, not topical, but Kam Singh says, "Would a Game of Thrones Iron Throne using real swords mortify you?"
Sorry, repeat the question.
A Game of Thrones Iron Throne. So that's a throne made from swords welded together. Would that mortify you? I guess he means using historical swords. Sorry, you've frozen there on me. Sorry, folks, just trying to get Ranjit back. We lost connection with him briefly. There, got you back.
My phone came up with a message saying it was overheating and it needed to cool down.
Oh, okay.
So I put the air conditioning on. So you put
good
a
idea. Gosh, it is a warm day.
So just be warned, it may do that again. I hope not.
That's okay. We're close to the finish line here anyway, but there's some really fun questions coming in from, well, fun comments coming in. So the question was, a throne made from antique swords, would that give you an absolute fright, or do you think that's a cool thing to have?
Generally, yes. The answer is yes, it would. Because, you know, I want any antique swords, any part of our history to be preserved, if it can, in the proper way. If they were swords that offered no cultural significance, and they were going to be scrapped or thrown away or of no use, then then maybe there's an argument for it. That's not my decision to make, you know.
I mean, museums are museums are filled with swords that aren't on display. The stuff that we see is just the tiny tip of the iceberg of what is actually held. I suppose the argument is that might be a fun use for them. And apparently, according to Thierry, there's a dude in Essex who makes garden benches out of bayonets.
Yeah, well, I think that's a bit of a historical thing, because I've seen houses with kind of fencing. You know, I'm talking Victorian housing. It wouldn't be Victorian, but it's talking kind of post-war houses with fences made out of bayonets. So.
Oh, really? Repurposing?
Yeah. So
it's a cultural practice.
Yeah, I think it probably is.
Yeah. Just to finish up then, we did touch on this, but I didn't actually get to ask you. Are you looking for any, have you got your eye on anything in particular at the moment for your collection?
Well, I told you about the almost there with the Sikh helmet story. That's something that would be what dreams are made of.
Why are they not easy to come by? Were they just rarely made?
Yeah, they were made under the famous Sikh king, Ranjit Singh. They were made under a very short time during the Sikh Empire for select important people, rulers or generals. As far as we know, they're less than a dozen of them. I suspect there's probably no more than that were made. Apart from that, there's a few things that one sees in books that you'd never ever see in reality. I've got a couple of things. I don't want to say too much. I've got a couple of things that I've been quite lucky that, you know, in my years being interested in this field, that there's two or three go-to books. One is Stone's Glossary. Stone's Glossary of, I mean, it's got a really long title, of arms and armor from Europe and, I don't know, the Asian world or something. But it's a glossary of arms and armor from across the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I would encourage everybody to get a copy. The Stone collection went off to the Metropolitan Museum and forms a large part of what is now their collection of arms and armour. And there's certain objects in there that I've always looked at, admired, and wish I could find one of those. And you never see them. You know, the Met have got one and that's it. And then there was another book by Egerton, Lord Egerton of Tatton.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, it was the catalogue of the India, what was called the India Museum, which was formed by the Honourable East India Company, which went on to become the South Kensington Museum, which was then renamed as the Victorian Albert Museum. And there's things in there that you see and admire and say, wow, I would love to find that, and you just don't. And I've been quite lucky recently. I've managed to find two or three of those special things.
Awesome.
And they're to be unveiled in the coming months. So watch this space.
Watch this space. Very tantalising there.
Yeah.
On that note, Ranjit, I'm going to have to say thank you so much for coming and talking to me this evening. It's been lovely to talk to you. Very hot day. Too hot for your phone.
It is.
Best of luck with your search for those treasured objects, and thank you once again.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for everybody that listened.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. To show your appreciation, please give us a 5-star review on your podcast platform, or support our work by becoming a patron at patreon.com/swordwomen. Go to @swordwomen on Instagram to see upcoming interviews, or visit buythesword.net to learn about our events, or visit our Facebook page, By the Sword.